Welcome to Circular Firing Squad. I'm Marty Gensius, a counseling faculty at Kent State University and a host for Circular Firing Squad. We've got four members, four questions, and four answers for each question. Questions are generated by each squad member and run from the silly to the serious. Let's see who's with us for this episode.
Hi, everybody. Elliot Ingersoll here. I'm a professor of counseling at Cleveland State and host of Apply Topic.
Hey, everyone. Gina Martin. I'm an assistant professor at University of Wisconsin-Whitewater.
Hello, everybody. My name is Mitch Conrad, and I'm a now second-year graduate student at Cleveland State University.
Elliot, you've got the first question.
All right. Here we go. With humanity's attention span changing, are we instructing potential counselors with a curriculum or with curricula, that are the equivalent of a buggy whip?
I appreciate this question, Elliot. I feel like there's a lot of back and forth on this, and I feel like the curriculum is changing, particularly in our curriculum at Whitewater. I feel like we've got a three-year program. It feels lengthy. It feels slow. It feels like the appropriate developmental level at each year. I've noticed, you know, this weekend we had graduation, and I got to see some of the students that I had in their very first classes and their practicum and all that starting out. And now they're graduating and they're completely different people. So seeing that developmental, shift is really good. And I think that we are doing fine with lengthening that and like stretching it out and giving the appropriate amount of time. What I think is changing is how we teach it, like chunking it out into like smaller bits and pieces, you know, i.e. TikTok video, edutainment, stuff like that. So I feel like that's where I see the change and the shift is in the chunking it out, making it brief, palatable, lots of breaks, lots of humor. Anytime we can, you know, break it up, that's what I find helps.
Yeah, I was thinking about our program, Cleveland State as well. Gina, I know that you said that yours is about 3 years. A lot of our students are in, kind of in between two and four. And so like Elliot, I think what I'm hearing you say the buggy whip, it seems like there are some students in the program who seem pressed to finish in 2 years. And in our program, you're there for two semesters and you are going into prac. That is very quick, especially for people who may not be coming from like a social sciences profession, although that doesn't guarantee that you have great communication skills or know much about, you know, basic psychology. I do wonder about how fast is the pace, even with colleges, like are programs looking to produce students as fast as possible and get more students in as fast as possible and get them out and then get them in, and it being like a restaurant type environment? Or is this something like a three-year process that's more balanced for students?
I took this question completely different from, I think, how other folks had taken it, and it might have been intended, but here's my answer anyways. When I think of equivalent of a buggy whip, I think it's, I didn't think about how quickly students are moving through the program. That I think is a problem. So I agree with Mitch that there's a lot of quick movement. People don't have an opportunity to embrace an identity, what a counselor is, because they've got to get through, because they, 48 months later, they need to be sitting in front of a client making money. So I didn't think about it in those terms. I thought about it in terms of what we're losing in the way we're teaching now versus what we're getting in the way we're teaching now. And I think we are out of date in a lot of ideas, but unfortunately, we've moved from thought to skills. And what I mean by that is our students can't think like a counselor before they be a counselor. So I'm hearing a lot of cognitive behavioral therapy. Just give me the cookbook, give me the worksheets, because I want to hand out worksheets. And I'm going to do, each week a client comes in, I'm going to do a structured dog and pony. So we're not thinking about what it means to be a counselor or what our identity is as a counselor. and we're focusing on empirically based concepts for whatever reason, and I'm air quoting that empirically based. I think what I'm seeing is, unfortunately, developmentally, students can't move into the identity of a counselor. Example, which drove me nuts this year. I teach marriage and family counseling course. There's a bunch of theorists we go through. Gave the first exam. The first exam was, here's four of the theories that you've worked on. Now I want you to respond to this case from the voice of the theory. What they did was they told me all the facts about the theory. So they had studied it well, but they could not step into the role. So we practiced those opportunities more through the rest of the semester. And I essentially asked the same kind of question on the final with a different case. And they can't say, okay, I've learned about emotionally focused therapy. Now I'm going to become Susan Johnson, and I'm going to tell you about this case in the framework using the language of emotionally focused therapy. That disturbs me for a couple of reasons. It means they're not integrating the information. And secondly, from a larger sense, it means students can't make the identity shift that they're going to have to make when they're working with clients. Because if they can't shift into something that they've studied and speak from that voice, how are they going to shift into what we call empathy with clients? So that's where I think we're doing a disservice to our students. And when we do this, get through the program, and maybe use antiquated concepts or stop using them because they're not empirically based, we lose a lot of students' ability to think through their identity as a counselor.
Great answers, folks. Thank you so much. Because it's something I struggle with. And yeah, I get it. I'm not your average kind of like whatever person. So maybe I always have to consider the things I'm contemplating are just a bit out there, a bit whacked out, you know, out of left field. But I'm just like, yeah, I look at all of the, I think I told Mitch this actually after a class. I'm bringing back the phone racks. I got these phone racks from Japan. And yeah, I give 3 points extra credit on the final exam if you rack your phone every class. And you can pick it up on the break. But yeah, I'm wondering about this. And the responses are helpful to me. It's like, no, we have to teach the skills that we teach. And those skills, they take a certain amount of time. And they certain amount of time to integrate. And I'm like, yeah, and you're never going to get around that. I will say, though, oh, gosh, as someone who's lived in a family where, oh, my goodness, we could have used family counseling. And we could have used it like right now, but we couldn't find anyone to meet our schedules. And I'm like, what the? But I'm like, well, we're totally willing to just do this. And but then I'm like, oh, wow. I have this real mercenary streak in me, which those y'all know that. Mitch, you're learning that. But you know, I do have a mercenary streak. And I'm like, okay, oh, here's something. What if we made house calls, just a specialization track? And I'm like, you know, not talking about your court ordered house calls. I'm like, look, you got a family. They want family therapy. They're really that stressed out. Here's the thing. It's not just house calls. It's like you don't have to rent office space. If you market this properly, you can be the house call counselor. And yeah, there has to be some screening. Not every situation is appropriate for it, but I think a lot of situations are. And I think some entrepreneur out there who's a decent counselor is going to make a lot of money just by saying, yeah, I'll come see you because you know what? Yeah, you're right. I sublet office space. You have one night a week free. That's not a week that I'm free for my subletting space. I'm going to come to you. I think an entrepreneurial approach to house calls might actually be in our favor. But yeah, dang, I'm sorry. I think I digressed there. But my point was things are changing, but the counseling process, the process by which people make things objects of psychological awareness, it just takes as much time as it takes. And no marketing campaign can ramp it up. It takes what it takes. And if you get a counselor out there who's like, yeah, that's cool, I'll make house calls, I'll bet you they're going to be making a lot of money if they do it the right way. That's just my take on it.
Okay, so the next question is, what's a hobby that you don't have time for now, but could see yourself doing once you retire?
Yeah, we're on a video call right now, and I've got a keyboard in my room that I've been trying to get back into and get back to playing piano. I've done that for about 20 years. I think the one thing that I'd love to do, though, musically, that I definitely do not have time for now is learning the saxophone. I love the saxophone so much. I have Spotify playlists that are just saxophone music, jazzy, summery sax music that I can just play all the time, driving in the car. But, you know, learning another instrument is daunting. It would be the third instrument that I've learned, and it takes years of time. Even if you can read music already, I remember they had in my elementary school, when we first got a chance to select which instruments that we used, they gave us a proficiency test. And the instrument that you scored highest on is the one that you got stuck with. So my sister notoriously got stuck with the trombone, and I got stuck with the trumpet. I never got a chance to play the sax. It was never part of my proficiency test. And I was always jealous of the saxophone players because I was like, that's the kind of sound that I would like to make. But I'm stuck with the trumpet, which is still fine. But yeah, I think it would be, I think I'd like to learn another instrument. Although my retirement age is quite far out. So
I'm sorry, Mitch, the one was the trumpet. What was the other one?
Oh, piano.
Oh, okay. I worked with a sax player in a band who his passion was clarinet. And I'm like, oh my gosh, you're such a fantastic sax player. He would get that sexy groove and almost like, oh my God. But he's like, no, you don't understand. You don't understand the virtuosity that's behind the clarinet. And then I heard him playing it years later, and he was right. He took that to another level, you know. But yeah, I just wondered, because clarinet and sax, the fingerings are the same, but the dynamics are radically different.
Yeah, way different vibe. Mm-hmm.
I think I would, until Mitch said it, I would say, well, I picked guitar back up. I used to play guitar quite a bit when I was younger. But when I first read the question, and without Mitch's influence, I thought computer user groups. That's a hobby that I don't have time for now. I attend some. Since COVID, there's been some that have been on Zoom, and I've been involved in them, but I really don't have time for them. I sometimes make time for them and get really frustrated. But I could see myself doing more with them once I retire, just to keep my mind active, to kind of work with other enthusiasts and work with other people who are new to it to try and help them solve problems. That's what I could see myself doing. But who's going to retire anyways? They're toe tagging me out of my office.
If you have your circular firing squad bingo cards out, yeah, I have an ADHD brain. So I do everything all at once. Today, I baked a dinner for my partner for Mother's Day, and her father brought it from HelloFresh. So it was kind of like, oh, it was easy. And then I made homemade bread, and I worked on some of my own bass parts. But, going back to, I think, with Marty, like, I used to do guitar stuff. I used to do solo stuff. But, it's a lot easier to grow old behind a bass. So I've kind of, like, fallen into bass stuff, which I really love. I've done it with theater productions and with a couple of groups. But I don't know. See, here's the thing. I don't know that I'd go back to guitar. I used to play guitar and sing, and I would loop the guitar part through a loop pedal, and then I would get on bass and I would loop that. And then I had a water jug strapped to the microphone stand, and I would play that. And I'm like, that's a younger man's game. I remember when I was like 57, I remember playing, and I would like to go without breaks for the whole 3 hours if I could. But I was like at hour two, and I was like, dang, I'm out of breath. Why am I out of breath? And so say, oh, you silly bitch, you're old. That's why you're out of breath. But, you know, it took me a while to kind of get with that. But I would say if I was going to go back to something, yeah, go back to guitar just for my own pleasure. Yeah, but the bass is where the money is. And there's nothing like playing music with other people. And if they want me to play bass, I'm like, I'll play bass, whatever you all want.
For me, I recently took up sewing. I went and I bought a sewing machine with my 4-year-old. Because she was really interested in it. And then I started to try it and I found myself getting really, really frustrated after spending like 3 hours with like, you know, the super itty bitty thread and super itty bitty needle. And my eyes couldn't do it. My fingers, I didn't have the dexterity for it. And I remember texting someone and being like, I don't even understand how anybody can do this for fun. This has been like the most torturous 4 hours that I've just wasted. And not to mention, I have like, you know, 50 million papers I need to grade. So I think I'm done sewing for now. And they were like, just, you have to have patience. You've got to sit with it. You've got to take the time. And that's when I realized I don't have the time. This will be a retirement ordeal if that ever happens. Like Marty, you said, I don't know. I'm still young and I know I have time, but if and when that happens, I might take up sewing. We'll see.
I got to say, Gina, my mom, she's 93, okay? And she had a sewing machine. It had a pedal. You go, whoop, 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 whoop. You got to work it with your feet.
Uh-huh.
And she would do all the stuff. And she was brilliant at it. But, you know, when I talked to her, she said, oh, yeah, my mom, her mom, well, she would beat me if I didn't do her. And it was like, whoa, you know? And it's like, she's not maternal grandmother was not a bad person. They were just under enormous stress.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like my grandmother did laundry and she needed my mom and her sisters to do alterations. And it was like, and I'm like, yeah, talked to her for Mother's Day. And I was like, I'm so grateful that you're my mom. And B, you know, we're in the 21st century. I don't like most of it, but that whole thing about the sewing machine with the thing that I don't have to work with my feet, I'm like, totally cool with that. She thought that was fun. But yeah, sorry, just had to throw that in.
Yeah. No, it's something that I feel like it's becoming a lost art. And I don't know, I don't want to lose that art, but I don't really have it to begin with. So maybe one day.
So this one was something that I've just been sort of thinking about over the semester. Question is, if you could create one new counseling class for your counseling graduate or doctoral programs, what would it be about?
That was an easy question for me. Actually, the class had been created when I came to Kent in the year 2000. And I looked at it because I looked at their catalog and I'm like, oh, who teaches the object relations therapy class? And they said, it's been on the books for years and they've never taught it, or someone who taught it then. I really am kind of an object relations guy and an attachment theory guy. And when we get back into all of this trauma stuff that people are hot on right now, it's attachment theory issues that impact a lot of the way in which people express the issues that they have. So it would be object relations, attachment theory, something along those lines.
Well, and Marty, I'm glad that you and I know each other. I consider you a friend because I never understood that crap at all. We've covered this on a couple of earlier shows. I always thought object relations was something really smart people talked about. Yeah, they feel really smart. Because I was like, I had a friend from Oklahoma, God's own redneck. And then this guy from California with a perm. I mean, it was stereotypically perfect. And they're going back and forth on object relations and Otto Kernberg. And I'm listening and they're like, well, what do you think, Elliot? I'm like, I think this is what smart people do when they're bored. I have no clue what y'all are talking about. I have no clue. So bless you. Bless you. You know, the class, you know, I'm a freaking mercenary. What I want is I want to find the cutting edge and I want to give that to our students and be like, hey, if you don't have any sense of boundaries and you get excited by stuff like I do, here's what I would do. House calls. Figure out a way to screen, you know, do a proper screening. But it's just like, we're not talking about court ordered. We're talking about people who really want help, but really don't have time. And they're struggling. House calls. Oh my gosh, that would be so brilliant. And then I'm like, you know, this is the thing, man. Most of the counseling faculty have been against me on this, and they may be right, which is what I love about our faculty. I'm like, yeah, I have these passionate ideas, but they're the people I trust. But they're like, oh, Elliot, oh, you silly fuck. No, that's not right at all. I'm like, coaching, life coaching. Coaches are eating our salary. These are people with a fraction of our knowledge, but they feign certainty. Oh my goodness, feigning certainty. That's what makes it in the American society. And I'm like, if we could do a coaching seminar where people just get the basic coaching skills, and how do you, as a mental health counselor and a coach, how do you discern whether the person has psychological symptoms that would impair their ability to benefit from coaching? Once you sort that out, then you can say, well, these people could benefit from coaching. These people can't. And we should be teaching our folks to do that, because, you know, money is highly overrated. But in the absence of anything else, it's actually kind of good. So I'd just be like, that's something I would. Home visits, you know, the house call counselor. Oh, my God. I have a brand already. It's called the House Call Counselor, HCC, House Call Counselor. Great. I mean, it's great. And, but I'm also like the other thing, you know, but I'm like, yeah, it was like when we talked about new counselor educators, and I said, sniff out where the power is. And I would say to new students, sniff out where the money is. A lot of you have that skill, and then figure out a way to get in there, but dominate it with your training, because these coaches, they have nothing.
So my answer is a little bit different. I think a blend of all of those things would be great. I also love attachment theory. I love object relations. I'm a huge psychodynamic oriented counselor. All of that is fabulous. And I don't think we talk about it enough in today's day and age. Going back to Elliot, your first question, we chunk things down in CBT, CBT, DBT, all of those fast oriented theories are much more popular. And that being said, I think that a great class on how to set up a private practice, how to actually do business as a counselor would be really helpful. Some real practical knowledge and business-oriented truths that people are going to run into when they get out into the real world. That would be really helpful. And then beyond that, we're going to go completely the other direction here. I think an entire class devoted to professional counselor identity and empathy would be really, really important. Marty, like you said, in your marriage and family class, I'm also teaching that this semester. And that is something that I've noticed, is that case conceptualizations are very, very difficult. And I think it's because we have a difficult time shifting our perspective from us or to the client and seeing things from the client's perspective, seeing things from a theorist perspective, all of those things, they do take time. And it takes practice to do that. So I think devoting an entire class to what is your identity as a counselor? Who are you as a counselor? Because we all bring ourselves to that role, and we can't divorce ourselves from who we are when we sit down in the counseling chair. So I think devoting an entire class to that would be really, really helpful.
Yeah, I appreciate everyone's answers. That's certainly some interesting stuff that makes me think about like what I was initially thinking when I shot this question to you, Marty. I think I'm pretty fortunate that I get a chance to talk with a lot of the students at our program at CSU. I think overwhelmingly they love our first counseling skills class for our introductory course, and they wish there were more courses like that. But then, based on what you were saying, Marty, about the idea that we're sometimes maybe too focused on individual skills, and so it made me think about what everybody's talking about with using something like marriage family therapy. I think it was EFT that was mentioned, like getting students to practice with other students, like what it would look like to, okay, I want to insert myself here as into this specific theory, as opposed to in a basic counseling skills class where it's just like, just learn how to just kind of talk to somebody for, 15 minutes and see how that goes. Doing some more advanced stuff, role playing. Maybe that's where I'm wondering if what that would look like if we went there.
You know, it's interesting, Mitch. I really appreciate what you just said and your thoughts on that. And like role playing, oh my gosh, I am so into role playing because I come from psychodrama and sociodrama background. And when I tell students like in psychopharmacology, I'm like, okay, if you want to role play a caregiver who's concerned about the meds that their loved one is on, or a client who's just like, well, how does this work? And I want to model what a non-medical mental health professional can say. I love that. And then when I say, okay, and Mitch, I'm like in psychopharm, I got 70 students. And I'm like, all right, all I need is a couple of role plays, man. It's so hard to get that. It's so hard to get that. And I'm not blaming the students. I'm just saying, man, we need to be better about inviting that. And I'm a mercenary and I'm an entertainer. There must be a way I can get that out of them. So I'm working on it, but I hear you.
And I think Elliot, though, that goes to the reason that students are apprehensive to do it. And I've seen this a million times. I always encourage students to do role plays and I always get the same like two students who are willing to do the role plays because I think that they don't know what to do. They don't know how to step into someone else's shoes. They don't know how to take on a different role. I did one class where role plays were mandatory and they had to do it for a grade. And now it was not like if you say the wrong skill, I'm going to grade you, you're going to fail. You know, not like that. It was not life or death. It was something like if you do it, you're going to pass. You're going to get the points. So you just have to step into a different role. And I had about 20, 25 students in each class that did this in each section. And about 10 of them, we got through 10 of the role plays. Every single student came into counseling, their role play, looking for help on how to manage school stress. And I was like, okay, look, we have to stop here. We're going to pause. We're going to take a time out. I'm banning school stress from being a topic because we have to branch out. We have to look elsewhere. We have to bring different things to the table. And the first group that went after that, they looked at me and they like sat there and they were like, I don't know. I need a pause. I don't know what to say. So again, this goes back to my idea for looking at a professional counselor identity. Who are you as a counselor? How can you bring some of your personal experiences to this role in a way that's not like self-disclosure-y, but that's you and that informs your counselor position?
I've got the last question for the group. But the question is, what's your end of the semester decompression process?
I really love this question because, and I am not talking shite about my employer. They've been very good to me. But I'm going to tell you, I quit teaching in the summer for a reason. A, I don't believe in 6-week semesters. I think it's shite. I think it rips off the students. And B, oh my God, you're going to refrigerate the rooms? No, we're not air conditioning. We're refrigerating. I had students bringing winter coats in. And when you got arthritis like I have, it's just like, holy socks. You know, I'm just like, I'm not into it. I am teaching in summer because my daughter got into Kenyon College and there's a reason. But I'm also like, okay, how am I going to decompress and how am I going to get ready for, another thing? And I think one of it is the old out of office message, at least for a week. Just, oh, piss off. I'm not available. That's fine. And most students are like, oh, of course you're not available. I'm not either, Dr. Ibe. And I would take that in good humor. So I think that's part of it. But I'm like, now that I'm going to be teaching in the summer, I used to look forward to 3 months of working on fiction and scholarly papers. And now I'm like, yeah, I don't have that. But I'm also like, I don't know. I love our students. I love our program. And so what I've done is try to build a way to kind of count down, wind down, not do a lot of heavy physical exercise during the week between spring and summer. I used to, but now I'm like, no, I'm coming back in summer, so that doesn't matter as much. But I'm also like, get my, I got everything graded as soon as I could. I worked very hard at that because I want to kind of, have a ending and a beginning. And I had a couple of students who had problems with the grade. That's fine. And it's like, oh, we already went back and forth three times. We sorted it out. And it's not even Monday of break week. So I'm like, yeah, I try to compress everything, deal with it by Friday or Saturday of the week before. And then break week, I'll get masotherapy once. I'll do workouts about four times. And my kid and I, my son's back from Kent State, so we're going to reinstall him in the back half of this third floor. That'll be my break week.
I think it's a big transition. This week we had finals and then we had graduation on Saturday and we've got to be there all day. So this is a really just time intensive week. And the first thing that I do after that is I clean out my house. I don't like clutter. I like everything to be very neat and tidy. So I will go through and just clean out old clothes. I will clean out old Millie's toys and maybe some new Millie's toys. I will just go through and get rid of a ton of stuff. That is my first, when the school year ends, I'm moving into summer, got to get rid of all of the old stuff. So that's the first thing. And then from there, similar to you, Elliot, I like to run, and you all know this about me. So I'm going to be doing a few 10-mile runs coming up, which is really, really relaxing and exciting for me. I'm running a big event June 4th, so I'm going to prepare for that and just dedicate this next week to really like putting in the time and effort on those long runs. And then from there, working on research. When I teach a 4-4 load, which I do every semester, I can't do as much research as I would hope to do. So this week I have booked out several days where I will be driving to a local coffee shop and just cranking out multiple IRB proposals on that. So that'll be my break.
Yeah, the cleaning part resonated with me because it's like as soon as we get to spring, typically we got to wait a little bit just for the weather to turn. So it's nice outside, can open the windows. I know that like this question kind of caught me off guard in a way, because it's like, what is your decompression process? Well, in the past, I definitely would have said just nothing, just unplug for a week and do nothing. And I can't do that anymore, but I also don't think I want to do that anymore. Because then I feel sometimes that I get so disconnected from like some of the stuff that I actually like want to do. So I'm made sure to, you know, I'm going to be taking classes in the summer, you know, full-time job over the summer. I got a vacation plan to go see the nieces and nephews. So trying to make sure that I think my decompression process is actually maybe a recompression process, and just like, how do I keep doing some stuff right now to make what's been a really great first year at Cleveland State kind of, you know, I want to feel some continuation there, I think.
I have a hard time answering this question, even though I posed it. I think I have taught every summer since I've been here, and I teach a pretty heavy load in the summer. So generally the time that we have, which is about 4 weeks between the end of the spring semester and our summer semester, I'm doing class prep. This time I'm going on vacation for about 10 days with my wife. What I've found over the last couple of days is I am sleeping excessively for about 3 or 4 days after the end of the semester. What I mean by that is usually there's one nap in there sometime during the day. Now there's two, sometimes three, and that'll occur for about 3 or 4 days. And then I'll get back in gear because I have the convenience of doing that for 3 or 4 days. There aren't meetings. There aren't things to teach. There aren't. So once that's over with, I think my real decompression is going out to movies with my son and when my daughter can join us too, because this is when the summer blockbusters start. And so that's like a big decompression piece for me. All really good different answers. That's it for all of our questions. We got one final shot question actually contributed by Mitch. I wound up using it as a final shot question. What would you choose as your superpower?
I was a little thrown off because that was like assuming I didn't have one.
Okay. I think that my current superpower is reading really fast. And I love that superpower. And I do read things really, really fast. And I would want that to be like 10x what it is now. So that would be what I would choose, is just like amplifying my current superpower.
I'm going to go with and this was something that I think, Elliot, we've talked about, was the ability to control time. Really, I've been trying to think about like how much this superpower would be able to give you and what you could do with it. I asked one of my other friends and they said invisible, and like trying to compare that, like, well, what would the difference between if you could stop time and you could, you know, and no one would know that you're there, or could go anywhere that you want, or you'd read maybe as much as you want to. I don't know if that's how the stopping time would work, but yeah, I think controlling time in some aspect.
Well, I went for something a little bit more altruistic than reading and stopping time. I would be bit by a radioactive Dalai Lama, and I would have mental balance for myself, and I would be able to transfer that to other people. With other people, it would probably just be common sense. But if I could contribute that to humanity with my superpower, that's the way I would go. Thanks to the firing squad this week, Mitch, Gina, and Elliot. Look for some of these characters on their podcasts on thepodtalk.net. You can find out more about them at circularfiringsquad.net. Our theme music is from Menage a Quad, Real Swing Shet. That's it for this episode of Circular Firing Squad. Ready, fire, aim.